afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan, and there is no Bill because he is homesick. Poor Bill. Tell you what, if you haven't had the shingles vaccine, you might want to think about it.
Yikes. Yeah. Well, Happy New Year.
And you too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bill managed to drag shingles from 2025 to 2026. Not good. All right. So how about this? Our free advertisement of the week should go to the Epoch Times. You'll find out about that a little in a little bit. But they have a thing called California Insider that they produce, and our guest from today will be part of that in the future. I don't know exactly when that's happening, but it's imminent. How about that? Today is kind of a part two. We started last week with the looming gas crisis in California. I would really encourage you to make use of the website. It is wethepeopleradio.us. Radio is important. Somebody has some of the other websites, but wethepeopleradio.us. Type it directly into your browser. The show from December 28th and then today, January 4th, are tied together. We sort of did... It's funny, as I was driving by the hospital, it kind of made me think, like, last week was almost like triage in the emergency room. This week we're checked into the room, and now we're going to start running tests. So
that's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah. So we decided, yeah, you belong in the hospital, so we've now checked you into your own room. This whole thing with the oil and gas, the refinery production, it is not just a California problem at all. And I think we'll make that painfully clear today. The thing I want you to go to the website and look for, first off, the bios of our guests that I'm going to get to in 4 seconds. Here we go. This is why you care. If you live somewhere else, this comes directly from their 10-page report that I have linked on there. To compensate for California's actions, the American taxpayer will have to pay additional costs and fees to acquire, transport, and store the fuels that were once produced in California. So there's your wallet. So you should care about that. And from a national security standpoint, I believe we will be hammering that point home today. The national security stuff is absolutely hair-raising. So our guests are Professor Michael Miché. The $64,000 question is it Miché or is it Miche or is it one of the other 15 variations that I have heard? we're going to get to the bottom of that today. Professor, how in the heavens do you say your name?
Okay, Happy New Year to everybody, and it's Miché.
It is Miché!
So we appreciate your answers.
So we didn't spend 2 hours last week calling you the wrong name.
I was
right. That's all right. You should see me in class trying to pronounce some of the names of my students.
So, oh, I'm sure, but
understandable.
It was just kind of funny. I listened to something that you were where they quoted you, and they had some other, but I'm like... The guy also called it rodeo instead of rodeo, so I was like, could be the guy. So you are an associate professor of the practice of management and organization at USC. He's been on the USC faculty since 1997 and has 43 years of global management consulting experience with strategic planning, which just must make living in California absolute torture. You're probably in therapy. It deals with mergers, turnarounds, and strategic innovation in both the classroom and with clients. I have his whole bio on there online. My source for all of this has been Mike Ariza, who is a Navy veteran. On a previous program I listened to with somebody else, they called him a former Navy veteran. But once you're a Navy veteran, you're just a Navy veteran, so let's clear that up. And he was born in Fairfield and has worked in the refinery industry for a very long time. He is now at Chico State. But his expertise in this, this pinged his radar when they started looking at closing down the Valero refinery down there in Benicia, where he used to run the Valero refinery, and was like, wait, they're doing what? We had a conversation, and he said, I've been talking to these two other guys, and this is huge. So that kind of brings in Mike. He also has a paper on there I've linked called The Point of No Return. It's fairly short. What is it, two pages and some change?
2 pages.
Yeah, and it's...
Yep. Short to the point.
Yep. It absolutely, if you need the 30,000 foot view, go to Mike's bio and look at the attached, The Point of No Return. And then our third player is Assemblyman Stan Ellis, but he is less an assemblyman and more an industry guy. So I don't know that he is with us yet, but.
Yes, I'm on, Aaron.
Oh, you are? Okay. Alex said, I think there's only two guys. I'm like, which two? He goes, I don't know. I was like, we'll roll the dice. Bill's not here. We're going to have one of those kind of shows today. So, Stan, you have been in the oil and gas industry for like 40-something, 50 years, something like very long, correct?
That's right. That's right.
And in what capacity or capacities?
Well, I kind of a long story because it's 50 years, but been in Kern County 50 years. So to kind of summarize, I started out in the drilling fluids business, which is kind of on the chemical process side of drilling and production, where we actually drilled the wells, and then we produced the wells. And then I started my own company, and then we did really well, and then there was kind of a downturn in 86, and I moved downstream into the refineries and developed some processes, chemical processes, in the wastewater treatment plant of the refineries. And I actually operated in every single refinery in California and then built several other companies, and even one was a quantum physics lab. I had it for 14 years. So I've been in business more than I have politics. And kind of to summarize this why we're here today, the professor has done some great work and background work. And I met him actually on the Insider down there at the Epic Times. And then Mike Ariza came to my office in Sacramento and had this two or three page paper, and it was so spot on. I went, who is this guy?
And how does he know all this?
The three of us have kind of combined our experience and our world experiences, and here we are today, and thank you for having us on the show, Aaron.
Yeah, absolutely. We our format caters to a long-form discussion. You know, sometimes people say, oh, you should have more call-ins, you should do more. It's like, nah, kind of a big fan of let's bring people on who know stuff and let them talk, since that is something our media got away from a while ago and has prevented us from getting smarter, I think. Not going to go so far as to say it's made us dumber, but I think that case could be made. So for today's discussion, we don't have to go back through, obviously, everything we did last week. That show is attached. I would encourage people to go listen to the emergency room triage show we did last week. It was very good.
Is that what you titled it?
No, but, you know, I should. I'll change it. A trip to the emergency room. And like with all trips to the emergency room, you kind of run in there with your hair on fire. And so this week we've been admitted, and we need to really peel it apart and look. I would really like to get into some of the numbers. I know we went over those last week a little bit, but I don't think that the average person in the country really realizes the impact that this will have, and specifically on the military. The military numbers are mind-bending. Here was just one thing from your paper. I don't know what page this is. Page 8. Travis Air Force Base receives its jet fuel from a private pipeline from a Northern California refineries, predominantly Valero. So in order to make up for this, the state would require an additional 1,333 tanker trucks per day to transport fuels and crude oil. Could you imagine putting 1,300 trucks on the road anywhere? Like, anywhere at all. And using railroad tankers, just in case that was one of the options that somebody was thinking of, that would require 44 more cars per day and still needs truck support. So this will affect everyone no matter how you cut it, and the volume of fuel used by our military, the jet fuel, all that. I don't know who wants to start, but can you lead us down this down this trail, guys? And they're all not in the same room, so now they're all reading each other's minds.
Well, I think that Mike Ariza was at the Valero refinery. He understands logistics there probably better than anyone. And then Professor has done such an incredible job with statistics and numbers. So I'm going to defer to those two gentlemen for this segment.
All right, Mike, we close Valero, and we're going to put 1,300 trucks on the road. Is that you guys wrote this paper, so it isn't like we're debunking someone else's work. Where would those trucks ballpark? Where would they start? And obviously they terminate at Travis Air Force Base on Highway 80, kind of middle of California.
Yeah, just east of Fairfield. The problem with getting all those trucks is the infrastructure. You got to get the jet fuel here. You still got to produce the jet fuel. Valero right now, Valero currently is at reduced rates on their crude unit. They're bringing in their different feed tanks. They're basically trying to get all their tanks down to minimum. And that's going to take a couple of months. They're also in the process right now of clearing tanks. So like you have two coker feed tanks, two cat unit feed tanks. You transfer all your, what you have left into one tank and then take the other one out of service and clean it. So they are physically now in the process of shutting down to mothball the plant. With that, you took out, on an average of, 600 to 700 million gallons a day of jet fuel that's produced there, which, does go to Travis. It supplies Travis. So you got to bring that fuel in. And to the best of my knowledge and talking with the professor, in fact, we were discussing it last night, is the ports are pretty much maxed out on what they can bring in. It's, you know, they're bringing in gasoline, they're bringing in jet fuel, they're bringing in crude oil. So it's a matter of you got to get that in there. Travis does not have the infrastructure to take on a bunch of trucks like that. I don't believe the infrastructure exists because normally, 90% of refineries, like Valero, 90 to 92% of everything it produces goes out by pipeline. Less than 10% of what they produce goes out by truck. And that'll include things like product coke. That'll include propane, you know, some gasoline. For the most part, all of the jet fuel and all of the diesel all go out by pipeline. So the infrastructure is not there for the rail cars. The infrastructure is not there for the trucks. It doesn't exist. And you have to get it. You actually have to physically get the fuel from somewhere, which it's coming from South Korea and Singapore and countries like India. But again, right at this point, the terminals, to the best of our knowledge, the terminals, the ports, they're maxed out on how much they can offload. So we're in a real critical area right here. Also, Valero's at reduced rates, but we were talking last night, and Professor was saying that the PBF refineries are both going down, PBF in Martinez and PBF in Torrance. That's a combined rate of 316,000 barrels of crude oil a day, 7.3 million, give or take, gasoline gallons a day, and 1.5 to 2 million gallons of jet fuel. So Valero's going down. Their jet fuel is going down, albeit they're just supposed to be temporary for their shutdowns. They call it turnaround. And then within 40 to 45 days, they'll be back up. But you know, the professor obviously speak on this, but I think at this point with California's infrastructure, it's impossible to get that fuel, if we can get it in here and actually get that fuel to Travis, certainly not by tanker, rail car, and by truck.
No, and that is one place. The only reason I highlighted that is a lot of, you know, people might know where that is potentially. But when you look at that, California's home, this is also in your report, California's home to some 50-plus U.S. military installations, which include but are not limited to the Pacific Fleet in San Diego, Alameda, and Point Point Loma. United States Marines are stationed at Camp Pendleton, 29 Palms, Miramar, and Barstow. U.S. Coast Guard ports and stations located along the state's 840-mile coastline. U.S. Air Force bases at Los Angeles, Edwards, and Travis. Missile bases at Vandenberg. U.S. Navy postgraduate colleges in Monterey. The amount of fuels used are all in your report. And maybe when we come back, let's take a really quick break, come back with Professor Miche, and maybe you could talk a little bit about, I don't know, anything you want. How about that? You could do whatever you like, but the military part is mind-bending. I really hope people will go online, look this up. It's a 10-page report. You don't have to be a rocket scientist or a refinery operator to read it. It makes perfect sense. You have great numbers in there, charts. It's all laid out. So there is no reason to argue with your neighbors about whether or not this is factual. You could just take this little 10-page report and hand it to them. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
All I do is drive, drive, drive. Try to stay alive. Keep my mind on my load. Keep my eye upon the road. I got nothing in common with any man who's home every day at 5. All I do is drive, 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 drive. If I can get the fuel.
Better enjoy driving your life away now while you still can. So, Professor, where would you like to focus?
Oh, let's just start. Let's go through the numbers and make it really simple for folks. How's that?
Perfect.
Okay, cool. So if we take a look at California in total as a state, we consume anywhere from 580 to around 610 million barrels of oil a year, okay? Now, that's anywhere from 31 to 38 billion gallons of crude oil. All right, of that amount, so call it 600 million barrels, of that amount, about 98 million barrels of crude is associated with jet fuel, okay, jet aviation fuel consumption. And of the 97 million barrels of crude consumed for jet fuel, call it 98, about 10 million barrels are associated with normal military aviation operations. So that's an important factor because in California, the fastest growing segment of demand or consumption of all fuels is jet fuel. So jet fuel is actually increasing and is predicted to increase all the way through 2035. So it becomes very important. We have more commercial traffic. Both SFO and LAX are gateways to the major regions, Pacific. They're global airports. We have more flights. We have the Olympics coming. We have the World Cup coming, so we can expect more demand for jet fuel over the next few years. Meanwhile, our capacity, as Mike Ariza pointed out, our capacity to build the jet fuel is declining. So what are we doing? We're importing the stuff from India and China, and South Korea. And that's just untenable over the long term. So it's kind of an interesting set of equations that we're looking at.
That's a really generous characterization.
It's the first of the year. Let's be generous and hope for the best, okay? So if you think about it, right? It's a relatively absurd. Now, I know that there's a lot of confusion out there with people about what's the what's called the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Oh, yeah, good point.
SPR, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll get questions from folks. You know, even some of them will recognize me and we'll start a conversation. Some will throw tomatoes at me. Some will be very polite and ask me good questions, and we can engage. And so a lot of the times I get a question is, well, what about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? Don't we have enough gas there? And the answer is no. You have to understand the Strategic Petroleum Reserve is all oil. It's crude. It's not gasoline. It's not jet fuel. It's raw, untreated crude oil. So that oil still has to be refined. But shockingly, right, our day supply of fuel in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve has declined 62%, okay, from 1225 to 1227-24, it dropped 62%. Joe Biden's administration drained it, in part to try to bring crude oil prices down, which it had no impact on crude oil prices. But so our strategic vulnerabilities are complicated a little bit by the lack of fuel going into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Now, the Trump administration is replenishing it. However, the difficulty is now that much of that reserve, the infrastructure behind the tanks and where it's stored, has to be retrofitted and repaired and things like that, because so much of it has been drained. So that's a little bit of the situation that we're looking at today.
And even if we had more there are no inbound pipelines to California. So let's say we kept the refineries up and running and we needed the oil from there. We can't even get it.
Well, the only way you're going to get it is, obviously, you can truck it in. That's expensive and you need a lot of trucks. You can try to bring it in on trains. I just did that calculation for ethanol. And we can get into that in a minute, because that's a crazy number. Or you do it the plain old way that California does it, and that's put it on a tanker and bring it up through the Panama Canal to California. But the problem there is you have to use tankers that are certified under the Jones Act, which is a restricted tanker. We have less than 50 tankers certified for the Jones Act. So with no pipelines coming in the state, we're out of luck and really can't count on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to come to our rescue in any way whatsoever. This problem is clearly created by California regulations and policies, and therefore could be corrected by that if indeed the state wanted to do so. But we're probably forecasting that by 2035, we're going to probably see refinery production decline by another 35% or more. And therefore, we're going to have a continuous stream of increasing gasoline prices. And by the way, the only thing that's keeping these prices from going, sky high right now is the price of crude oil. The price of crude oil has dropped by 22%. Therefore, the price of gasoline has dropped precipitously. But even today, we are still 52% higher than the national average in California, 52% higher than across the country. So, it's not the consumers and it's not the refiners. You have to look directly to policy and the cost of regulatory provisions.
Terrifying.
One real quick note, Dan. One of the things that we haven't mentioned is the fact that we have these different crude sources and we're trying to pick and choose, but what happens is these crudes are different qualities. There are different sulfur contents, different viscosities. So it complicates the refining process, and it limits their ability to be to optimize. Anyway, I just wanted to interject that as another complication in our crude purchases.
Well, it makes sense, because for you to weigh in, we'll go, obviously everybody will have plenty of time, but it makes sense then to look at production, because that's where you have expertise, is in the actual production and pulling oil out of the ground. So we're not having a crisis of availability of oil in California that we can be sourced here, correct?
That is correct. We could come up to that million barrels a day over the next few years. Unfortunately, we're inhibited, obviously, by all of the permits and getting permits from CalGEM, Air Resources Board permits, et cetera. So I can go on and on and on. if we unleashed the beast, we could actually do really well here and cut our imports dramatically.
Yeah, and let me add to what Stan just said. We have the fifth largest reserves in the United States, and we're sitting on an abundance of oil. I mean, offshore, an abundance of oil, not only in Kern County, but L.A. County has an abundance of oil. And so if you look at the work from people like Jamie Richter from Berkeley, you know, it definitively shows how much oil we have. We have an abundance of oil. We have the fifth largest reserves. We have the ability to produce that oil, but there are so many limitations and restrictions placed on it. There's very little incentive to move out into those fields to do anything.
I think my biggest fear is servicing and bringing back the contractors with drilling experience and production experience. Both of them have left Kern County and gone to Texas. You just can't go out and throw a drilling rig on a site and drill a well. You've got to have experienced personnel, you know, and it takes time to drill these wells. It takes expenses and money, and a lot of the oil and gas companies have lost confidence in our oil and gas sector here. So why would they invest here? So there's a lot more hurdles. Yeah, is the oil there? Absolutely. But our administration has created such a difficult environment to work in that nobody wants to really invest here in oil and gas. Why do you think all these other companies are leaving the state?
Yeah, and that's the same. You know, as far as the refineries, the experienced personnel. But back to the oil, I was doing some numbers. We've lost from 19, like the mid 80s, up to 2023. We've lost nearly 700,000 barrels a day of crude oil processing capacity. And then with the idle refineries since 2023, Marathon and Martinez, Rodeo. And with Phillips 66 and Valero shutting down, there's another 686,000 barrels a day of crude oil processing just in 2.5 years that has gone offline. So just in the 2 years, our crude oil processing ability has dropped 35%. And then since, you know, like 1990, with all the other refineries that have shut down, you're looking at 50 to 52 to 53%. And it's like the professor did with the two gentlemen from Berkeley. You know, it's amazing. Our crude oil usage capacity has dropped that much, yet we were, back in the day when our usage was really high, we were only importing, I forget, it's like 6 or 8%. Now we're importing nearly 70%. It shows you how it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and put it in context, because we'll talk a little bit, you know, not only about consumer consumption, which is not going down, by the way, of gasoline, nowhere near what the CEC or California Energy Commission said it would or the California Air Resource Board. Let's look at a typical air wing, right? So you're sitting out on, let's say, I love the USS Ronald Reagan for many reasons, right? And it's a Nimitz-class carrier, and it has F-18 Super Hornets on it. And there's around 40 aircraft to an air wing on that vessel. All right, that air wing will consume, under combat operations, 800,000 gallons of fuel a day. A day.
Yep. Yep.
Just to keep an air wing of F-18s flying in our defense. The Super Hornet alone burns 1,100 gallons of fuel an hour. You know, and then you gotta add a bunch of that because they'll go to afterburners, right? So, you know, it defies our imagination as to how complex this is and what it really takes in terms of fuel to support America's warriors, when they're out there defending our country. And so when you have this significant decline in production, in state production, that can have an effect. And it's not only just California. We haven't talked about Nevada or Arizona yet either. So there's some major implications on them. So there's really some really fascinating statistics. You know, Pasadena, the Rose Bowl always has the B-2 bomber fly overhead. Well, that burns 3,300 pounds of fuel per hour. That's a lot of gallons. Okay.
Per hour.
Up there, and that,
I mean, like,
an hour.
If you kind of game that out, if we were in a war situation, multiply that by the planes, the time, all of it. I mean, this whole thing runs out of juice pretty quick.
Yeah, and you have Travis, where you have one C5 Galaxy and one KC-10 fuel extender, not counting the fuel that the fuel extender has on board for refueling. They take about 90,000 gallons of fuel for one sortie. And Travis is the primary military airlift command that in Dover, the whole world. So if we need to get to different locations, if Taiwan or some other theater opens up, you're going to be burning around 80 to 90,000 gallons of fuel per sortie. So, you know, 10, 12 sorties, you're well over 1 million gallons a day, and the primary refinery that supplied that jet fuel is offline.
Yeah, the wheels come off this pretty quick as you start looking. And those numbers are actually in your report. The other one, too, the Boeing, maybe Professor, maybe tie it all up, a Boeing 747. Where is that in comparison? Because Lord knows we've got plenty of those in the air.
Yeah, that's about 63,000 pounds of fuel. All right, that's what it carries. So, you put that in proportion, the Boeing, the B-1 bomber, which is, a beautiful aircraft, that will hold about 265,000 pounds of fuel. So, military aircraft are built for one single purpose, to fight and to win, all right? And to fight and to win, they have to have great fuel capacity as well as weapons capacity. So, it's very interesting when you start looking at these numbers and quite honestly, quite alarming that the California... actually, our governor, Newsom, and the California legislature has such an appalling lack of appreciation for national security and also the implications on California refineries on the economies of Arizona and the economies of Nevada. It's just simply shocking.
I think that. I'm sorry, Sam. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Mike. Well, I was just going to say, in the big picture, this kind of brings us collectively to why we got together and came up with these ideas on national security, even though it's obvious, and it's becoming more and more obvious. You take these 40 some military bases and the three in Nevada and the 10 that we're supplying part of the fuel to in Arizona. In the big picture, where are we going to get our fuel?
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, it's just as simple as that. And if we can't protect our borders, and there's an incident in the Pacific somewhere that knocks out fuel ships, knocks out production crude oil ships. Guess what? We're done.
We're done.
So it's scary, and I'm really worried about our national security, let alone the public crisis.
Well, and you think about it,
yeah.
To that point, when you're looking at, like the professor's talking about, the B-1 capacity, the B-2 capacity, 787, 747, but our C-5s, our C-17s, our fuel extenders, you start pumping out 1 million or 2 million gallons a day of fuel to, so we can fight in the theater, and for people to even say, well, we'll just get trucks or tankers, that's absolutely ludicrous when you look at it. It's like, it's insane. The military has to get busy. There is no way on earth that we are going to be able to truck those amounts of fuel to those bases.
Well, it presupposes we have it, right? We have a little problem. Yes. We're trucking it from locations we actually know that now won't be in production. Oops.
Right now we have a big problem, and it started 3 years ago when they pulled Marathon offline. They switched Rodale. Rodale switched over to the renewable diesel. But the problem it's been going on, like the CEO of Chevron said, for 20, 25 years. The state's been at war with the refineries. But the real effect, and like Stan was saying, that we got together, is the effect on the military. And that actually started 3 or 4 years ago. About 15% of our jet fuel got dropped offline back in 2023. And it's going up higher to 25, 35%. when Valero goes down, it'll be pushing, you know, 35%. Total jet fuel make is gone out of the state. The tankers, to the best of our knowledge, are maxed out at their unloading rates at the dock. So, yeah, the source. And then to think, when the military gets busy, we're actually going to be trucking it to the bases. That is not going to work.
Gosh, and, you know, you're our adversary. How, you know, how third world would that be, you know, to disrupt? That'd be simple. You know, that'd just be a simple disruption in our entire military readiness. We have to take another quick break. You guys have a mind meld and see what you want to come up with for the next 15 minutes. Light everybody's hair on fire. Here we'll listen to a little more car music. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile, my curiosity running wild. Cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile.
Better hang on to all that music so we can play it. Remember when we used to do that instead of walk everywhere? I guess investing in a good set of shoes right now is probably a good idea. And I was glad I didn't have to ride my bike to the station today. It was raining so hard you could hardly see. Anybody want to tackle the impact on the public, just in case everyone hasn't already figured that out?
Well, I can start. It's Professor Mache, and my colleagues can fill in and elaborate. I think, you know, the impact to the public is the following, and we identified this in our May 5th paper, and then the chair of the CEC, Vice Chair Gunda, came out and really parroted what we had to say, more politically correct, but parroted nonetheless, in his letter to Governor Newsom, and that is the following, that what's happening is California's placed itself in a position where now it is extreme, it is completely reliant on foreign sources of gasoline to meet its current demand. There's absolute no question about that. We're losing 6.2 onward to 9 million gallons of in-state gasoline production a day. Demand is not coming down by that, period. So to make up the difference, you have to go to foreign markets. That means that all of these regulations that California passed on behalf of the consumer, okay, to, you know, regulate supply and to stop price gouging and stop profiteering by the refiners now goes out the door. They're gone because California's reliance relates to advocating its domain and authority over refiners in our state. Because now we're relying on refiners in India. So can you imagine the California legislature going to India and telling them how to run their country and how to run their refineries and how to price their fuels? So we've abdicated that through these policies. And the result is now California is in a far more vulnerable position to supply chain disruptions and the whims of foreign governments in terms of how much gasoline they want to produce and how much they want to sell it for. Not to mention that most of the ships that are coming over are owned by China and Russia. So the supply chain, to even get them here, you're using ships that are owned by foreign flag companies and foreign governments.
Yeah.
So for our consumers, we could easily look. I'm not saying it can happen, but I'm sticking with my original models of over $8 by the end of 2026. You could be reasonably considering $8 plus a gallon by the end of 2026, which is doubling what they are.
Well, that's if we don't have an event.
Cool. That's a very cogent point, Stan. And why don't you walk our listeners through what happens when you have an event?
Yeah. What is an event in the land of oil and gas? Just in case we haven't considered that.
Well, let's just suppose that there's interruption. Let's just take, for example, with Valero shutting down, we're going to get 40% of our gas and diesel and jet fuel from India, okay?
Mm-hmm.
40% of California's gas. Well, 40% of India's crude source comes from Russia. If Russia wants to pull the plug on the Western U.S., they just stop supplying India. What does that look like when we can't get crude? That's just one example. There's hundreds of examples. What if there's a storm? What if all day long? What if the ports, for example, in California get backed up? What if there's a fire in the port? What if we have a pipeline that goes down? What if? That's in a perfect scenario, $8.
Yeah, and those things you're mentioning, Stan, those have happened in the last 8 weeks. We had a fire at the El Segundo refinery, a big one. We had a fire at the Port of Los Angeles on a cargo ship. It wasn't a tanker ship, but the fire was so big they were worried about the dock being damaged. So they pulled it out of sea and away from the dock. These are, we had the pipeline leak. It was in here. It was up in Washington to shut down the Olympic pipeline. There's so many. There's so many things, again, $8 plus a gallon, but that's perfect running, no issues. But there's many incidents, and these are real-world events that have occurred. Valero's not down yet. Valero goes down, then we have another refinery outage, and the supply goes away real quick, and the price is going to shoot through the roof. And the real reason I got into this initially was I was concerned about shortages. I was worried about civil unrest. I know Valero is the most efficient advanced refinery in the state. The fact that it was shutting down is what caught my attention, like Stan had said before. But we're looking at, any significant disruptions, any significant events, including recent events that we have just had, could potentially result in serious shortages across the entire state and Phoenix and Nevada and Reno and Vegas. And then back in the 70s, people handled it back then. But with the toilet paper shortage we had and the way people were acting, I think people are going to go crazy. I don't think they'll handle it at all. And that's what worries me. That's really what worries me is something like that happening.
Yeah, if you think about it, the fuel crisis we had, but you know, the fuel shortage we had before, we hadn't even invented microaggressions yet. Imagine we all are sitting in line at a gas station. That's going to be awesome.
What's really sad from my perspective, I think, is being in the state legislature, and I'm a one-termer. I'm a business guy and a working man, and I get up there, and I have the frustrations of dealing with folks that don't have a science background, and they came from, they were a city official, then they were a supervisor, county supervisor, and then they got elected, and all they know is 80% of them, all they know is government. And
right.
Then they fall into being in the super minority. All I hear from my Democratic colleagues is how dirty oil is. Oil's dirty. Well, And then they have this green agenda and greenhouse gases. And frankly, it's so hypocritical. It is unbelievable because of the ships bringing in, we've kind of covered this before, and polluting the atmosphere and the refineries that have no human rights and no environmental protections in these other countries. And they're polluting the atmosphere. And they expect us to be perfect. California expects us to be perfect. And then they drive this green agenda with electric cars, that 80% of their power comes from natural gas. And, if you got to drive a electric car 122,000 miles to be carbon neutral. we are just, we make 6,000 products.
Which is just awesome. Do that again, Stan. Tell us that one again. How long do you have to drive the electric car?
122,000 miles to be carbon neutral. Okay, so your tires are styrene, butyl styrene, which comes from oil derivatives. your plastics are plastic derivatives that are pressed, and everything's made by natural gas and power, electric power. So it's just frustrating to me that, yeah, is it good to have an electric car around town? Sure, that's kind of cool. But to have a whole state and 33 million vehicles go without fuel because you want a green agenda, it makes no sense to me at all.
Yeah, well,
so it's really frustrating.
We see out here, at the far northern end of the state, where it's cold and you drive long distances between things. I mean, I handle three and a half counties up here at this end of the state, and I drive for work. And I've put 51,000 miles on my car in 2 years. Not two and a half, but two, straight up 2 years. And that's just, basic meetings and stuff like that. But it's, you drive a long way. So they mandated these, they incentivized them to buy an electric school bus. I won't tell you where they fell for it. Bernie, California. And they can't do the whole route. They don't have enough juice to run the whole route to pick up the kids. That's not dangerous.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't New York State have a problem with electric school buses not providing enough heat on the buses in the wintertime? I think there was a story that last week or the week before on that.
Oh, terrific.
Upstate New York, it's pretty cold. I grew up in that part of the country, even though I came into California. So I declared California my home state because my father was in the service, and I entered the country entered the United States through San Francisco. So, but I grew up back east, and I can tell you, upstate New York is pretty damn cold. And apparently, well, they had these electric buses, and the buses weren't providing the heat.
Wow.
Power to the engine or power to the propulsion system or heat. And we know in cold that battery-powered vehicles lose 25% of their range due to the cold temperatures. So,
and in 20 below zero, they'll discharge.
They'll discharge, yeah. They die very quickly, yeah.
I was raised on a pig farm in South Dakota, so I know what it's like to have 20 below weather.
Yeah. I grew up in Connecticut, and we had a tank of oil in our basement, and that's how we heated the house. Guy overfilled it, the tank popped, filled our basement with oil. That was all really exciting. I mean, we have different needs around the country for transportation, heating and cooling, all those things. I mean, there are lots of places in the country that don't have air conditioning. We don't happen to be one of them here in California, especially up here where we are. All those things, they are not all going to be replaced with, unicorn urine. I don't know what we're going to run everything with, but
sunshine and farts.
Yeah, there you go.
You go back to Stan's point about the legislatures not knowing, you can't make just jet fuel or diesel or just gasoline from a refinery. Professor, correct me if I'm wrong, you were telling me about some PhD in a meeting who thought that, who's in these decision-making meetings, thinking that a refinery can just make gasoline. It can't do that. But these are the people, like Stan saying, that are in making the decisions that have no idea on the subject matter.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was talking to somebody, and they said, well, we'll just have the refineries just make gasoline.
Okay.
And I said, like 100% of gasoline? And yeah, 100%. And I looked at him. I said, have you ever, you know anything about this?
It's
not done like that,
Well, to both mics on this note, there was an article that we've seen on a Washington refinery being able to supply 140-some thousand, one of you guys came up with the fact that they're taking
it. Yeah.
Go ahead, Dan. Go ahead, guys.
145,000 barrels a day they were going to supply of CARBOB gasoline. That's the Sinclair refinery. Their crude oil rate's 145,000 barrels a day. So, no, you can't make 145,000 barrels a day of gasoline, CARBOB gasoline, or any other gasoline. It doesn't work that way, but that's...
Good Lord. Guys, we have to take a break for the news. When we come back, we're going to hit a whole bunch of this still. National security, some ideas on solutions and things that can be done. I really hope people will go read your reports and pick up on the show we did last week with you. You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us.
Solving puzzle pieces. High time to come to Jesus. You got skeletons in your closet, spitting all over your face. Every little lie stacked so high, can't keep your story straight. I don't know how they got there. It's getting under my skin. You got skeletons in your closet, and I got bones to pick with them on.
Theme song for Gavin Newsom, the musical. I couldn't resist it. Oh, man. All right, so we are back with We the People, just in case you, I don't know, just tuned in. Why would you do that? You should have been listening the whole time. You can always find us at wethepeopleradio.us, and the important part of that is the archives stretch back like 15 years. We've done a lot of interesting shows, things you wouldn't hear elsewhere. On China and Islam and wolves, ugh, the bane of my existence, and tons of shows on cannabis and pot and illegal cartels, and I guess illegal cartels is sort of repetitive. It's redundant. Cartels are all illegal. All of that stuff, and you can listen at no charge, and Robert, who's sitting here hanging out with me today, pulls the free enterprise moments out so it's uninterrupted, and I think you'll like it. Easy to do. You just go there, click on stuff. Today's program is the part two of the looming gas crisis in California, which is actually the national security crisis looming, and a bunch of other, just a lot of looming. We should have just called it the looming. We have Mike Ariza, who is down at Chico State, but he used to run the Valero Refinery, Professor Michael Michaud from USC, who is given us a bunch of numbers on these things. Assemblyman Stan Ellis, who is actually a oil and gas industry guy, an on-the-ground guy in Kern County, just happens to be in the assembly because he just felt like he should torture himself for a term there. I'm not sure why.
Torture is correct.
Yeah, it's got to just be hell. So I guarantee you, you went there thinking, you know what? If we just put our shoulder to the wheel, we can make it better. I'm gonna go there and see what I can do. And you went in and looked around and went, what the heck? I haven't asked you that, but you know, just kind of guessing.
Well, you're right. What happened was I have grandchildren, and I've been in Kern County 50 years, and I have family, and I think, golly, I could really go do some good here. I could really, I could really do what you're supposed to do as, you know, and it used to be years ago, people worked their whole life and had a career and had a family. Then they went into public service and you didn't have that much partisan politics. It was about common sense and doing what's best for your constituent. But when you have a leadership in Sacramento that drives their own policy, and the legislators really have no voice because they get penalized if they don't do what the leadership wants, we have a sad state of affairs. Mm-hmm. And then being in the super minority, they know they're going to, no matter what you vote on, no matter what you do, you have no say. It should be unconstitutional. But I don't know how to fix it other than just get more Republicans voted in. That's the answer.
Yeah, get some balance back. Well, you know, Don't even get me started on the whole term limit
thing. Yeah, I'm sorry to get off topic.
No, that's okay. The term limit thing walked us right into this. You know, we have no historical knowledge under the dome, and the agencies run everything. It just was a terrible idea. It takes away our access to the Constitution is our vote. And now with the open primary, you have the top two primaries. So in many places, you just have you have two Democrats. You don't even have really opposition in the general election. You just have the lesser of two at some point. It's just, I don't know. Yeah, it has sent us down a bad path. So here we are on the bad path with this looming gas situation. Do you guys, are we ready to talk about like possible solutions that you have kicked around? I know I sent you an email from one of our listeners with some ideas. Anybody want to go there yet?
Yeah, I'll jump in first. Jack did a great job, by the way. So good job to him.
Dr. Jack Budney, my neighbor.
Yeah, very, very intellectual and spot on. I'm going to talk for 1 minute, but I think the other two mics are a lot better versed at this. But my solution would be to get rid of regulation as far as CARB, get rid of CEQA, get rid of cap and trade, let's go to work. That's the next few years' solution, in my opinion, to get industry back excited about doing business in California, and I think we can fix it. As far as federalizing, I think politically I don't know where that's at right now, but to Jack, a couple of Jack's questions, yes, the Pentagon does know, and the professor's done a great job going to Washington and talking to senators and congressmen. He has a great network there. So, Professor, I'll kind of defer to you now.
Well, you know, we can't approach this with piecemeal, all right? We know SB 237, as good as that is, isn't going to solve the problem.
And for people who don't live here, SB 237 did what?
237 was passed by our legislature to allow for 2,000 new drilling permits a year. For the next 10-year period, predominantly in Kern County. So the idea is, well, since the drilling permits under Gavin Newsom declined 97% during his tenure as governor, to increase production, which is badly needed in California, let's pass 237, which allows for new oil drilling. Now, it's questionable how many wells we'll actually be able to drill a year, but that's a different set of numbers and issues. Mm-hmm. But that was one. And then the second sort of component of the centerpiece of the governor's solution for the energy crisis is AB 30, which allows for the sale of ethanol, E15 gasoline blends in the state of California. The governor's claimed that it could reduce prices by 20 cents a gallon at the pump and generate $2.7 billion worth of savings. Well, mathematically, that's possible. Pragmatically, that's a wish list at best. So these aren't going to fix it, although I would say 237 went a long way of sort of getting us going. Compliments to Stan and Shannon Grove and people like that, Brian Jones, who helped move that bill through the California Senate. What I think is what's required now, as Stan indicated, is a true holistic approach to addressing this. No refiner is going to enter the state under current conditions.
Right.
It's just absurd. And when the governor tried to sell Valero ostensibly to foreign refiners, they all passed on it. No U.S.-based refiner wanted to buy it. Nobody wanted to take it over. And the issue is they don't want to operate under California's regulatory structure and high cost structure. Remember that our refineries cost operationally anywhere from 25 to 38% higher than the national average because of the cost of doing business in California. OK, Okay.
And they don't get any, they get nothing for that. They just pay more for the privilege of living here?
Yeah. They get nothing for it. It's in fact, when they
fantastic.
Are profitable, they're demonized and accused of price gouging.
Right.
Now anybody that knows anything about this industry knows it's a yo-yo industry. Stan will tell you, Michael will tell you, they lived it, I've studied it. In this industry, it's boom or bust. You will have great years. You will have years that you can't sell the oil. As a matter of fact, it wasn't too long ago, only maybe 8 or 9, 10 years at the most, where you had to pay somebody to buy the oil contract. In other words, the seller had to pay the buyer to buy the contract. That occurred somewhere
kind
around
of an unsustainable plan going forward, right?
Right. So California has unsustainable plan. What's required is a complete holistic approach to the legislation here. A repeal of something called 1137, which is the setback rule. You can't have oil production within 3,500 feet, 3,200 feet of certain buildings and locations. Now, there's no science to back that. You can ask the legislature, show me the scientific reports on the setback rules. None have been provided, as far as I know. Then you can look at the other one, ABX 2-1, which is provides the California Energy Commission with the statutory ability to mandate that refiners hold finished gasoline as fuel. Okay, so think about this. You burn through, what, 35 million gallons of gas a day? You want them to hold 15 days supply at $1.74 a gallon? That's going to add anywhere from 5 to 7 cents to the price of gas, just that alone.
So and what was the benefit of that, or what was the perceived benefit of that?
Well, the idea of that was that the refiners go down, planned and unplanned production interruptions, and prices go up. So the idea is, create a large buffer inventory, which, by the way, is impossible because they don't have enough capacity, but let's just assume they do, that you'll provide a buffer inventory of gasoline so that when they do go down, that buffer inventory can be introduced and moderate any price increases, spikes, right?
Sure.
Okay, that works, except you're not counting for what we call in accounting the holding cost of inventory. So, you know, anybody that owns a business knows, well, the longer I hold the inventory, the more it costs me. I have to pay for it somehow. I'm going to pay for it through a price increase. So the cost of holding that inventory by the refiner will be built into the consumer price, and that's anywhere from 3 to 7 cents a gallon. And we're going to pay that on every gallon of gas we buy, irrespective of whether there's a price increase or a price decrease or a shortage or a surplus, doesn't matter. They're going to build that in. Things like that aren't considered by the CEC or the California Air Resource Board when they pass these regulations. And that, I think, is something that has to be addressed and stopped immediately. But I think what's required is a complete look at and a re-architecting of the state's policies on oil production and refinery operations. It's kind of incredulous to me that you would fine Valero $82 million. They're going out of business. They're shutting down, and you're trying to sell it to a suitor, but you're not removing the $82 million lien you placed against them. I mean, it's incredulous, and I think it all.
You're trying to marry off your daughter so you shave her head.
That's one way of looking at it, right? You know, or as you might say in Pennsylvania, you're gonna spray paint that heifer brown and call it beef. You know,
Aaron, your metaphors today are amazing. I just have to say that.
I'm gonna add the heifer to it too.
Hey, can I ask a really quick question? So putting ethanol into gas, that's kind of like putting ice into your whiskey. You don't have more whiskey, right? Is that how that works?
Yeah, so ethanol is produced, as we know, in the United States. Ethanol comes from corn, and so it's an additive. It's alcohol. It will increase slightly the octane rating of the gas. It moves from 87 on E10 is the standard that we use now. That means our gasoline is 10% ethanol and 90% gasoline. When you move to E15, it's 15% ethanol and 85% gasoline. The octane rating will move from 87 to 88. But here's what happens. You get less miles per gallon.
Oh, terrific.
So even though the price will be cheaper, you're going to get about 2% less miles per gallon using E15, if indeed you can use it. Not all cars can use it. There's a whole different set of issues on which cars can use it and which cars can't
use it. So you're going to use more.
Right? So you're going to use more, right? So get this. You're going to use more in a state that's losing refinery capacity.
Right. Oh, my God.
Think about that.
I think my head's going to explode.
Think about that. Yeah, I know. It's a little hard for some of us to get our heads around.
Now, to
make up the difference, now we have ethanol in our state. We've been using it for a while, E15, although it's not very available, okay? And we have refineries that produce it. But we did the calculation yesterday, and let's just see what that calculation tells us. So if you're looking at ethanol, our production was about 190 million gallons of ethanol last year. Our consumption was 1.4 billion gallons of ethanol. That means we imported something like 1.2 billion gallons of ethanol. Okay?
Wow.
To import that amount of ethanol, and this is just on a modest amount, okay, this is not wide-scale adoption whatsoever, required 40,000 train tanker cars. Now, 40,000 train tanker cars, if you line them up, they'll go from San Diego to San Jose. That's what it looks like.
Wow.
Now, if you want to increase that, and we're doing those numbers now, we don't have them ready, but we will publish them this week. If you increase that adoption rate, then, of course, you're going to have the need for more imports, and you're going to have the need for more tanker cars, and you're going to run into the same problem on the onshore side, the land side, with rail terminals, as you will with the port terminals on the maritime side. Yeah, you can line the tanker ships up out in the Pacific, and you can line the tanker cars up out in the desert, and you'll get to them one at a time, and you'll get to them, right? You'll offload them.
Yeah.
But it won't be very timely because you don't have the capacity to offload them very quickly. As one of my faculty colleagues said, geez, Mike, that's like going to the DMV. Yeah, they'll get to you. They'll get to you someday.
Yes, but will your renewal be this year or next year's?
Oh my God.
Yeah. We have to take a really quick break. And oddly enough, there's a band from the 70s called The Cars, which seems fitting. And I do believe that they were prophets because they came up with a song that obviously is how we're going to solve this problem. And that would be magic. Because really, that's all we have left to us. We'll be right back with Professor Miche, Mike Ariza, Stan Ellis, and you're listening to We the People Radio.us.
Dumb dead, sleeping in an alley, didn't matter to me. I got lost walking in the valley. Well, it could have been 1993 when it goes badly after burning so bright, trying to make sense. facts of a hopeless situation. Feels like dying in the middle of the night. When it goes badly, you're alone in the darkness. Nothing's ever ever make it right.
Yeah, yeah, when it goes dark. We should start working on more songs about darkness. My old friend. So, okay, back to you, Professor. Sorry, I'm done screwing around with the music.
We love the music. It's great. We love it.
Amen. Oh, man. Amen. At least maybe, I mean, it's funny because I'm sitting here with Robert, and he's like, this show is really depressing. And I'm like, I'm trying to fun it up with a little music. He's like, but it can't save us. I'm like, I know. That's all I have. It is just like one of those things where if this was the first time you had really gotten an inside look at what the California legislature is doing, it kind of sounds like maybe we're making this up. But then you look at the body of their work and, sorry, Stan, not yours, but everybody else.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're just a visitor. We're going to consider you a visitor to the California legislature because you wouldn't want to be an actual resident.
Thank you.
But good Lord, I mean, you would think, and I know we talked about this last week. You had said privately they will all admit, yep, huge problem, but publicly it's like, huh? Nobody's talking.
Yeah,
no,
that is true.
It's an ideology. It's almost like I'm sitting beside this Democratic legislator on a. This is one example of many. I'm sitting beside a Democratic legislator on a committee, and this bill came up on the suicide bill. And I looked over at this lady, and I said, "My Christianity will not allow me. I don't like people suffering, but as a Christian." To commit suicide is a sin. And I can't vote, in good conscience, I can't vote for this. And she looked at me and said, Stan, I'm a Christian too, but I'm a Democrat. I have to vote for it.
Wow.
That is the classic, I'm a Democrat. Well, I'm appalled. I'm blown away by how indoctrinated some of these legislators are, and every time you turn around, they say, oil is dirty, oil is dirty. And you say, well, why is oil dirty? Because it causes cancer and blah, 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 blah. But they can't explain why they consider it dirty. It's just that they've been indoctrinated and told it's dirty. They don't have any scientific basis whatsoever. But because they're indoctrinated, and that's what we are living with in the state legislature.
So, if we, so let's say we convinced the refinery folks to stay in business, the regulation through whatever means is modified, and they can continue to exist. I guess just me looking in from the outside, not involved in any of this industry, I'm thinking, why would I prolong the agony when I know that eventually some other administration is going to come in, put back that regulation, put their, you know, boot on my neck, and crush me in the future?
Sure. Well, Aaron, I think that's a cogent point, right? At this point, you have to question the credibility of the California leadership and California legislator, right? So, you know, if you're a refinery operator, you got to think second and third and fourth and really hard about how you're going to allocate shareholder capital.
Yeah.
Are you going to allocate it to refineries in California where you're always at risk? Or are you going to allocate the capital to refineries elsewhere where, you know, you'll have some assurance of operating without being demonized and legislated out of business? And I think that's really something that the California leadership needs to think through, but apparently has not.
I don't think it just pertains to oil and gas either. You know, it's certainly oil and gas and the national security are getting to the top of the visibility. But look at the other industries leaving. And that's directly related to the legislators' over-bureaucratic legislation.
Yeah, I might add to that, you know, if you take a look, we've lost, what, over 250 companies under Gavin Newsom. We get announcements weekly of somebody leaving or shutting down an operation and you know, staying in California, moving the operation someplace else. And we constantly or consistently rank in the bottom 10% on things like roads and education and economic vitality and ease of doing business, friendliness in doing business.
So it isn't. It isn't like any of this is translating into this utopia. You know, it isn't. It isn't like we have something to show for it.
No, and then some other. Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Professor.
No, please go ahead, Mike.
No, you go.
Well, no, like Professor's working on the ethanol thing. You know, let's. I was talking to one. I guess Fox guy, but the you know, the whole thing about this ethanol. Say it brings 20 cents a gallon savings. So give them the benefit of the doubt, which it doesn't, and the professor's gonna put out report proving it, but you know, just give them the benefit of the doubt. People aren't going to care when their gas is $8 or $9 a gallon.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, thank you. Now I'm only paying $8.80 a gallon. I'm only paying 3.5 to 4 times the national average now. Thank you for the ethanol. It's, you know, the whole thing's a ruse. While the 2,000 drill wells go in the direction, you know, with that bill, it's a start, but to me, I look at it, it's a ruse, too, because it's not going to compensate for the loss of well production, not even close. That's the professor and Stan, the professor and the gentleman from Berkeley in their report. And the only thing that's going to stop, the only thing possible thing, I think, again, the point of no return at this point, is the president, you know, sometime, hopefully in the near future, the Defense Production Act, National Emergencies Act, Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, because... Stan and the professor are saying, all these businesses that left, Budweiser shutting down and leaving California. And all these other businesses are going away. So, you know, this is, it's a systemic problem with this legislature, this governor.
Tell me this, on a practical note, Bill actually sent me a text question here a while back that I didn't look at. My bad. He was asking, how does the San Francisco airport get their jet fuel, and how will air travel? I mean, that's just one airport, but what does this do for air travel?
Well, Mike Arizo will fill you in on the details, but they're getting their fuel basically from the northern refineries in and around the San Francisco area, and there's pipelines that traverse under the San Francisco Bay that feed Oakland, SFO, and San Jose. Mike, you want to give them the details?
Yeah, well, we know Valero's supplying Travis, and then the main supplier of jet to San Francisco International is the Chevron, the Richmond refinery and Chevron from their Isomax unit. They had, at least back when I was working there, they had the contracts for their jet fuel, so that's where it comes from. And as our production goes down, you know, Valero goes offline. Now somebody's got to make up Travis, like we've been saying before. So you're going to see shortages there. You're going to see it's basic economics. You don't have enough jet fuel, you're going to see the price of tickets, the price of flights going up. I know before my wife headed to China a couple weeks ago, three days in a row, 787s were canceled going to Guangzhou. I don't know if that was fuel related, but you know, that's the type of thing you'll have. You'll see international flights, they'll get canceled for shortage of fuel. And then, you know, the price of tickets, just like gasoline being short, price of jet fuel is going to go up and price of tickets is going to go up with it.
So Professor,
on the bigger
stage, when you talk to the lawmakers and different things about this and you've discussed with the administration, how do you pitch this?
Well, from my perspective, I pitch the data and the implications of the data and what it means to the California GDP and the economy. what it means to the U.S. economy and what it means to U.S. national defense and force readiness. And so, you know, I tend to just, you know, defer the emotional aspects of it and look precisely at the data and where the data is telling us and what the trend lines are. And again, when you seek a solution from California, particularly the California Energy Commission, the answer is, well, don't worry about it. The markets will take care of it, and we'll just import more. Okay, fine, but you're not telling me how much it costs. And by the way, if you're bringing the product in from India, as I think Stan mentioned, 40% of their oil is coming from Russia. So, you know, mm-hmm. you are, to a certain extent, supporting the nefarious activities of Vladimir Putin. And then the second bit of that hypocriticalness comes from, if you're importing the oil from Brazil, well, 97% of Brazil's oil production comes from offshore. So we have abundant oil offshore California. So for some reason, it's bad to produce the oil offshore in California, but it's entirely morally responsible to take oil that's been produced offshore in Brazil and bring it to California. By the way, on an ocean tug, you know, that's emission, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, you know, for 12 days at sea. So, you know, the amount of hypocrisy is almost unbelievable in terms of how you can get your head around it. But I'll let Stan take over.
Well, I don't.
Yeah, Stan, fix it for us, will you?
Yeah, well, I don't like being an alarmist. Without substantiation. And that was the first thing that all three of us were concerned about. Are we trying to bring attention to something that is real? And that was my first concern. And after we get all of the data, it's real. So then, being solution-oriented, because you solve problems every day in business, then how do we fix it? And so then we come up with a solution that unfortunately falls back on the legislature that's greenhouse gas positive. So but I would tell you simply, there's about four or five things we could do to get us back on track. But it's got to go through the legislature, or Trump has to step in and federalize oil and gas. It's that simple. Well, it's not that simple, but it's a solution. The solutions are in front of us, and when our legislature sees the price of gas going to $8, hopefully they're going to do something.
Yeah,
we were talking about. Yeah, it's a lot of really good thought. The one where I kind of disagree with is the nationalizing. When you look at California compared to the rest of the nation, it's like looking at the satellite picture of the Korean Peninsula. North Korea dark, South Korea lit up. You look at a basic pipeline graphic of the country. There's pipelines going everywhere. There's no crude oil production problems in the country. They're $2.50, $2.60 down to $1.95 a gallon now. They're doing, the rest of the country is doing well. It's just California. California needs the intervention. At this point, I believe it's the only thing that's going to correct the problem. I just hats off to Stan for beating his head in that legislature. That one day I went through there, I'm just like, man, this place is crazy. that's just one day. But, nationalizing our refineries and companies, federalizing nationally, that's not practical. And it's like comparing apples to oranges. California is what needs the attention. California is what needs the intervention.
Yeah, I want to go back to 237 that passed. That was actually driven by, that was a Democratic bill, by the way. It certainly had my support.
To do more drilling?
It had Shannon's support, but it was Democratic authored. And in my opinion, that was to show that there was some, we have a problem and we think we're going to address it by 2,000 wells. We'll end up making about 40,000 barrels a day over the next 10 years, which is totally insignificant in our supply. So
So it was a feeble effort by the Democrats to show that there was a concern.
That they're trying to do something. Yeah.
Yeah, because look, 2,000 is a big number. Like, in an industry that nobody has any experience with and nobody knows, is that a big number or a small number? I mean...
Well, it's a small number. And then there's also the well stimulation process where you could double up the production of some wells, but California won't let you do stimulation because they compared fracking in California to fracking in Texas. There's no comparison. Fracking in California is just a little bit of pressure with a little bit of fluid using guar gum, which you can put into toothpaste to stimulate these wells. So that technologically they try to make more out of this than there is. So that's one area. Another area is the 230, the setback. The setback, I think 3,000-foot wells from sensitive receptors. Well, what is a sensitive receptor? So I guess what I'm saying is a lot of these make no sense.
Uh-huh.
From a scientific basis. I think Professor already made comment to that. There was no science behind it. It's all about popularity to their base, which has been ideology in greenhouse gas reduction.
Yeah, the new religion. And they really want to trust the science, only we don't ever really deal with real science. We have to take a quick break, and, since most of our fuel out here is now going to, come from Russia and stuff, I figure, well, we might as well, get in the mood. So you are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sure, she's working for the KGB in this paradise. Ah, cold as ice.
Interesting. Just like L.A., we're getting closer all the time.
I thought, comrade, I thought you were going to play Back in the USSR.
I have that one, too.
Yeah, we need to play that one. Hey, before we, let me just, can I change this just for
you do
a
it.
Slight second?
Have a field day.
You know, we passed this law on these underground tanks, right? Back in, 2015, 2016, that the underground tanks had to have a double wall. Okay, that makes sense. But apparently, as many as 500 gasoline stations in the state are non-compliant. many of these are in rural areas, right? They're small mom-and-pop stations. And so they're non-compliant. And apparently, under this law, if you're non-compliant, you either get fined an exorbitant amount of money per day, or you're out of business. Have you noticed anything going on in some of the rural communities related to that?
Well, I mean, we're digging up a lot of stuff. It seems like everywhere. We've also closed a lot of gas stations everywhere. Fuel's getting a little harder to find.
Yeah, they're unprofitable for them to stay in business. This particular law is not going to really impact too many people, especially where I live in Los Angeles or someplace like that. But certainly out in the more rural communities, it will have a significant impact. And so for that dealer, that mom and pop shop to be compliant with that piece of legislation would require them to dig up their tanks and put in these double wall tanks. Well, that's about $1 million to $2 million to do that.
Yeah, if you look in some of our smaller communities, those locally owned gas stations went away. They just went away, and they've been taken over by other bigger chains who could afford it.
Yeah, because the bigger chains can afford it, right? Mm-hmm. The small operator can't. And so I think this is something that we should keep our eye out for also, to see how many of these small operators are running out of the state as a result of that piece of legislation. Something I think we should keep our eye on, particularly for our fellow Californians that live in these rural communities. You know, I grew up sort of in both a city and a rural community, and there's big differences. The space between two gas stations was approximately 20 miles. you had to go 20 miles. So if the one station was out of gas, you drove 20 miles to get to the next station. And if they were out of gas, then you were in real bad shape.
Oh yeah, I mean, we have places up here that, I mean, Modoc County, the county in the upper northeast corner of California is still classified as frontier.
Yeah.
I mean it's not even rural.
Right, no, beautiful, but you know, there's going to be some issues up there. So
yeah, I got to Likely. I thought I could get gas there. I was on my way to Susanville, and I get to Likely, and the gas station was closed. It's like, I had to go back to El Turris because that's 2 hours. You're 2 hours from the next gas station.
Yeah. You know, and this piece of legislation may cause more issues with the distribution of gas. And clearly, when you have less gas stations, and it was a Stanford study that was done many years ago by a very prominent Stanford professor on the competition between stations. And of course, as we would all expect, and he proved, the further the stations are from one another, the less competition there is, right? So that's what you're going to have. So not only are you going to have increasing prices, you're going to have less competition, which will exacerbate the prices in those areas as well.
It's so before we run out of time again, I knew we'd run out of time again, go back to the nationalizing, to that idea that the federal government would come in, because on the one hand, like, yay, they would do a good job right now, but somebody else is going to be in power later. What does that look like? And besides, the whole idea is scary.
So let's go through it. You got to be a little careful when you use the word national.
I know, right? It sounds like we're going to play back in the USSR again. Yeah,
right. You're not. You're not going to be nationalizing at all. What you will be doing is, let's say you invoke the Defense Production Act. Okay, that's probably the most viable and easiest mechanics that the president has in place. This stuff about the Supremacy Clause, that'll be determined at the Supreme Court level and all that thing. So, you know, nobody's going to mess around with that one because that'll be court challenged. But the Defense Production Act in itself would provide the president the vehicle to come in and basically say this. The oil industry in California, and that's the entire industry, the oil under California, the oil above California, the oil producers and all the pipelines, that is an essential asset to the protection of the United States. Okay, those are essential assets. And the refineries as the same. They are essential assets to the viability of the United States and the defense of the United States. Therefore, we are going to take them regulatorily under the purview of the federal government. And EPA standards will prevail, and Department of Energy standards will prevail, and Department of Interior standards will prevail. And you, California, can't sit there and add legislation like 1137 to prevent them from doing things. Because when you look at the California legislation, it's all designed to prevent the oil and gas industry from producing. And so that would create this, what we legally call a prophylactic effect around these assets that would allow those refiners and the producers offshore, onshore, to increase their production in a manner consistent with what's required for national security, which would include supplies to Nevada and supplies to Arizona. So that's what that means it's not a nationalization of them. It's a legal protection that's provided to them from local interference.
But I think to Aaron's point, yeah, suppose we do get federalized, and then the next administration comes in and says, no, we don't need that anymore.
Yeah.
Then what happens? And I think that's the biggest fear with investment in oil and gas in California, and to Mike Ariza's point, it's the point of no return.
Well, yeah, I think, well, we're already at that. We're already at that point. When you've lost 20% of your capacity and it's not being replaced, and your demand is not coming down by 20% in a commensurate period of time,
mm-hmm.
you're at basically a critical point of no return.
We're there.
We're there.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Mike, but not to mention the pipeline collapse, too.
Right. Yeah, you got, and you look at this, you got combined here 120 years of experience. You got studies from UC Davis. You got the gentleman who is the CEO of the pipeline company in California, and you get Newsom to keep saying, there's no credible, you know. No, there's a lot of credible, and you're not listening. We're there. We're past the point of no return. We've been there for a little while. And the only thing that is going to help it is going to be federal intervention. And the only thing Stan, you know more because you're a legislator, working guy slash legislator. Perhaps the feds, the Congress, they could pass some laws that enact laws that protect, basically do the Defense Securities Act, but enacted into law where there's a permanent protection in place to keep this from happening again should another party take the next term. I don't know.
Well, the congressman from our district, Vince Fong, has been very receptive and has been floating this around Washington, D.C. We know the Pentagon has it. In fact, Professor, you've been more of a leader in this area than I have, but you might let Aaron know what you've done in D.C. and where this is at.
Well, I think we've done our best to talk to the lawmakers, and both Vince Fong and Kevin Kiley are aware of it, and Vince has taken the point on it and has done, I think, a fantastic job. He's done an incredible job of circulating it, socializing it, and making a lot of awareness. I've been told that the work that we've done, our report that Stan and Mike and I put together, has gone to the Pentagon and has been reviewed there. I've been assured that it's gone to the White House and it's under review there. So, we're just three guys trying to do the best we can with what we have. I do plan to go back to Washington early this year, and do the best I can to bring further attention to this issue because it's not being resolved, as we all know. 237 is not going to fix it, and ethanol sure as hell ain't going to fix it.
No.
So we need to do more work. And people, we're just average citizens. We're not being paid to do this work. I've been asked, I do a lot of research, I do a lot of publishing, am I being paid for it? And the answer is absolutely not. Every nickel, every dime is paid for by myself out of my own personal funds. So every trip back to D.C. is paid for by me out of my personal funds. I can, I don't want to show you my credit cards, but if you ever want to see them, you'll be crying along with me, right? That's what they look like. Trust me. We're doing the best we can with all we have. I think at this point, because of the lack of leadership in California, because of the inability of the leadership truly understand national security issues and global issues, and I fully believe that the only resolution at this point is for federal government intervention and invocation of the Defense Production Act, and we take it over from there. At least that will give us some assurance in the short term of continuity of operations and perhaps stability to our markets. This idea of importing millions and millions of gallons of gasoline on tankers across the Pacific Ocean is not really stability.
No. No, and that's not it's not a sustainable fix. You can't you can't do that for
Historically,
let me just say honestly, I would expect a high school student in economics to give me that answer. I wouldn't expect the California Energy Commission to give me that answer. Not with their operating budget per year.
Yeah. And at the end of the day,
it's a historically unprecedented dependency. It's like Professor saying, you know, it's like you got these people that got degrees and all that, they should know, but they don't. And yeah, a high school student could figure this out. It's not hard.
Well, I do think that this is pivotal. We will continue to touch base with you guys. We have to run away, unfortunately, but not before we hit your back in the USSR for you, Professor. So, Professor Michael Miche, Mike Ariza, Assemblyman Stan Ellis, thank you so much for all your hard work, and please go online, check out their hard work, and support them at WeThePeopleRadio.us.